Oh, what is up, man? It's a special edition of Canucks Talk Emergency Reaction Podcast, which has become a bit of a tradition here at the end of January for us. But as I'm sure you are well aware now, it's over. It happened. We are no longer waiting for Luan Godeau, at least as JT Miller is concerned. He has been traded to the New York Rangers. Now, as we're recording, the teams haven't made it official yet, but this is per basically every insider in the game. So JT Miller to the New York Rangers. We'll go over the full deal and all of that, but I got to welcome in my co-host, of course, from The Athletic, Thomas Drantz. And Drantz, I can imagine it has been a flurry of activity on your end since this deal broke.
Well, of course. And there's more reporting that I'm going to have to do, of course, across this weekend. So we're still in very much like first blush. What's the deal?
Yep.
What's our reaction to it? How did the Canucks do? Who won the trade? All that stuff. All that good stuff that people love. You know, I think there was a sense of dread around this one leading up to it. I think there was a belief that JT Miller was a distressed asset. Obviously, this is a complex situation. Really, this season has spiraled out of control. You know, we can chart it from the time that Miller took his, you know, a sort of unexplained personal leave in late November. But I think issues in that locker room date back further, date back to training camp. I think this has been a very trying season for Canucks management, for Rick Tocchet. Clearly, the chemistry in the room was broken. Jim Rutherford going on record to talk about the fractured relationship between JT Miller and Elias Pettersson. It all conspired to create this sense that this was a trade that the Canucks were going to lose, involving a distressed asset who was never going to bring back in exchange the same level of value that he had on the ice for this Canucks team. And so I'm of two minds before having captioned it that way. Jamie, do we want to talk about Miller in Vancouver, or do we want to talk about the trade first?
Let's run through the trade first, okay? And I'll give the pieces and the breakdown here. So going to the Rangers, obviously JT Miller, also Eric Brandstrom, RIP the Eric Brandstrom era in Vancouver, and unsigned prospect playing in college right now, Jackson Dorrington, who I believe was a 2022 sixth-round pick by the Canucks. And the Canucks receiving Philip Hedel, the center, 25-year-old center, oft-rumored to be the featured piece of a JT Miller return. 22-year-old right-shot defenseman Victor Mancini, who's played mostly in the AHL but did have an appearance or a stretch with the Rangers in the NHL this year, and a top 13 protected 2025 first-round pick that, should the Rangers pick finish in the top 13, it will become an unprotected 2026 first-round pick. So Miller, Brandstrom, Dorrington going one way, Hedel, Mancini, top 13 protected 2025 first-round pick coming to the Canucks. And look, as predicted and as you just laid out, the Canucks are a worse team on paper now. But from your perspective, and in particular the two guys who are, you know, tangible hockey-playing assets right now, Hedel and Mancini, how do you kind of assess that return for the Canucks?
Yeah, listen, I know people think I'm just a contrarian for the sake of it, and sometimes they're right, but I'm not in this case. I don't think this is one that we have to qualify. I don't think this is one where we have to do the rabbit in a hat trick rigmarole of, out of a bad situation, the Canucks were able to do the best they could. I don't think we need to qualify it. This is a trade that positions the Canucks better today than they were positioned yesterday. This is an outright win for the Vancouver Canucks. They get younger in doing this trade. They add depth and a pretty interesting lottery ticket in Victor Mancini, who's a big-bodied right-handed defenseman, so at a position of organizational need, right? Of organizational weakness, frankly, right? They've bolstered that. And that 2025 pick, okay? So that 2025 first-round pick, top 13 protected, converts to a stronger 2026 draft pick, unprotected in the first, in the event that the Rangers miss the playoffs, which is likely, right? They are... I think it's 5, but it might be 7 points back of the second wild card spot in the Eastern Conference. I'm sorry, I just wrote it. And
they're
now
5. They're 5 points back. Okay, so they have 52 points in 50 games. Columbus right now 57 and 51.
And Dom Lecision's model gives them a 36% shot at making the playoffs. I know they've been on a heater, but look, this is a Rangers team where their best players are all, with the exception, and there are big exceptions, by the way, of Igor Shesterkin and Adam Fox, are all over the age of 30. Panarin's 33. Mika Zibanejad is 31. JT Miller, obviously, is about to turn 32. Chris Kreider's 33 and is slowed down. Vincent Trocheck is 31. Alexis Lafreniere, Adam Fox, and Igor Shesterkin aside, you know, this is exactly, we used to talk about this when the Canucks were rebuilding, Jamie, and we talked about this in the wake of the Bo Horvat trade, which featured a similar, protection structure on a first-round pick, yep, acquired from a team that seemed fringy on the day of the deal to make the playoffs. Like, this is exactly the type of profile you want to bet against, right? Especially in an Eastern Conference mix where this season has felt like a changing of the guard. Columbus looks durably ascendant. Ottawa looks durably ascendant with far younger rosters. Montreal, right? I mean, there are teams in the East waking up here, playing really good hockey, already have better records than the Rangers do, who also are far more reliant on younger players with more upside. Like, the Canucks did a deal today that made them younger, right? And we'll get into Hedl and the risk profile there because it's massive, right? Don't get me wrong. But they got younger, they got deeper, and they acquired the highest upside asset in this trade. I don't know what else to say. Like, I'm not trying to make things up here. The Canucks obviously surrendered the best current NHL player.
Yeah.
But given where this team is, given how they've performed this season, given all the noise, given what we talked about on Friday's show, the idea that you can't be fearful of dismantling a non-contending team, right? Given all of that, where the Canucks have found themselves back in the middle of the NHL standings, this is exactly the type of deal they needed to pull off. This is an unqualified win for Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin, and I'm stunned by that, given the corner I thought, and I think most people thought, this club was backed into.
And it is ultimately, you know, as you said, like, some people are going to say you're being contrarian there, but realistically, this is also a player, a pick, and a prospect, which is like kind of the definitional trade for a star player in the NHL. Now, you know, I understand from Vancouver fans' perspectives, right? And it's, hey, he's a 100-point center. He can bring all these unique things. And that's true. And that's why, you know, they're giving up the most hockey value right now for the remainder of this year and probably into next year as well. But that's how these deals work. And so it is actually a pretty standard package for this type of deal. And as you said, considering the circumstances and the no move clause, like, that's pretty remarkable that it ultimately came together like that. Victor Mancini, we'll get to Hedl in a second here. Probably a name like I wasn't familiar with. I'm sure a lot of Canucks fans not familiar with, but a really fascinating part of this trade. And, you know, 6'3", he was a 5th-round pick in the 2022 draft, but he's already been able to make it to the NHL, playing NHL games this year. And, you know, came out of the NCAA, didn't have a ton of offensive profile in the NCAA, but what he's done in his AHL career, 13 points in 30 games, had 5 points in the 15 games he played for the New York Rangers. So I'm not saying he's ever going to be your power play quarterback or anything, but you start to look at it and say, okay, well, 6'3", and he's obviously got a little bit of puck skill, and that's a pretty interesting player to add to the Canucks depth chart on the blue line.
Yeah, he's a guy, honestly, who gives them an option today too, right? I mean, I won't be stunned if the Canucks give him a look sooner rather than later, perhaps immediately, to be totally honest with you, given, you know, some up and down performances that we've seen from the likes of Vinny Desharnais, right? And of
Noah
course,
Juulsen.
Noah Juulsen.
Yep.
Over the course of this season. You know, the statistical profile on Mancini, again, it's not super auspicious, right? I mean, you're really looking at a lot of like Madison Bowies and Keith Ollies and Ladislav Smeeds, which would sort of be the upside case in terms of what he's done across his 30 American Hockey League games. But there's a couple things I like about this player, and a couple things that have stood out to me as I've been asking around with various pro scouts. Speed profile is like he's got a lot of speed and transitional ability despite his size and a play style and a production profile, frankly, that trends more defensive. Right. So there's a little more get up and go here than might meet the eye if you just scan the back of the hockey card. Well, that's something this team's desperate for. And here's the other thing. He's a player that's taken a very circuitous path. You sort of touched on it a little bit in getting in the NHL. But I mean, U.S. national development team ends up going over to Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Plays in the Allsvenskan and the Hockey Etten, and then returns to the NCAA for 3 years, has sort of carved out a pretty promising a little pro career here in terms of playing already 15 NHL games. When you're a player who, you know, has consistently found a way to beat the odds, which is effectively what we're talking about, right? Sort of didn't make it in the USHL, didn't make it as a mainstay on the U.S. national development team, didn't sort of take the path of least resistance, went and tried to play against men in pro leagues in Sweden, right? Ends up at the J20 level, plays pretty well, ends up in the NCAA, found a way to get drafted, right? Like found he's continually found a way to beat the odds, and you like to see that. Just from a character standpoint, especially when you're talking about a guy who's going to have to beat them again, even where he's already at, which is 15 games into an NHL career, an incredible accomplishment given the background and path that he's already taken. But he's still going to need to beat them again to become a regular because truly, you know, most fifth round stay at home defensive defenders who at no level have produced significant offense end up being like 250 NHL game career guys, right? Like there's still odds that he has to break, but he's found a way to beat them to this point. The Hedl part of it too, I think's fascinating because, I mean, Hedl's a good player. We've seen him be, you know, a 45, 50 point guy, a credible middle six center. And frankly, a guy who's occasionally looked like he can have top six impact. The issue really has been that he's significant, like he's never been durable.
Yeah.
And he's had repeated head injuries in particular, which is terrifying, right? That's one of the scariest things you can have in your profile. Obviously we've seen with Michael Ferland and Tucker Poolman just across the last 5 years in Vancouver, how scary it is for players, any player, when the sort of repetitive nature of concussions become something that a player is almost constantly dealing with or chronically dealing with in Hedl's case. You know, even this season, he's produced at a 40-ish point clip. His profile's kind of similar to JT Miller's in that, you know, he can hold up in a checking role, but really his value is more offensive than defensive. He's obviously not the face-off winner that Miller is. He's not the heavy player type that Miller is. He's not the power play ace by any means that Miller is, but you know, he's a decent stopgap in the middle six. He's a player with some untapped upside too, because if he can stay healthy, you know, I think you're getting a 45 to 50 point center. Like, I don't think you're much worse than league average down the middle going Pettersson, Hedl, Pugh Suter, right? I'd love to see them have a big bodied right-handed centerman in that mix. Like, very much so, but I think Hedl's good. Hedl's good if he can stay healthy, which is a big if.
A massive now, if here, yeah.
Massive if. The thing, though, is to remember is that, like, the most important thing that the Canucks accomplished with this deal was they retained no money. Mm-hmm. They retained no money, and so they've cleared Miller's entire contract and saved. I mean, I know Hedl's making a little bit more than four, right? So it's
4.4, you know, yeah, 4.437.
Right. So they've added 3.6 million. Is that right? 3.6 million in additional cap space to play with in addition to Hedl. Hedl's downside case that the head injuries are something that he never manages to escape for long in his NHL career. You know, there obviously downside there, there is a chance that the Canucks get a meaningful, useful contributor out of Hedl. But, you know, I sort of think about it as if unfortunately the downside case hits, then that is cap flexibility from a Vancouver perspective, right? So more than anything, I just think this, when you factor that part of it in too, I just think you have to think of this from a positioning standpoint, right? You can't think of this from the perspective of, well, this dents the Canucks cup chances. Like, hate to break it to you, I don't know what you've watched this season, but there were no cup chances to dent. Okay. Like there weren't. And what they've done here is get younger, add upside, get more flexible, and get deeper at a crucial position on the back end. I don't know, man. Do you see this wildly differently when I sort of elaborate on it this way?
You're right. You have to divorce the high of last season from what we were seeing this year. And the reason I find it relatively
Seen for the last six.
Yes,
it's not even just like a 1 year blip, right?
The reason I find it relatively easy to do that is because Jim Rutherford is bluntly giving us the diagnosis. You know what I mean? That it is, in fact, this specific issue. And therefore, we're going to move on. And if we get the flexibility, we get a pick. As you said, get some young talent with some upside. Okay, you got to do that and you got to figure out a path forward. Now, we got to do a couple things here in about like 6 or 7 minutes before we got to get out of here. One, JT Miller's time as a Canuck. So he finishes 11th all-time in franchise scoring, 437 points in 404 games across 6 seasons. And the question now is, okay, what will his legacy be in Vancouver? And the word that comes to mind for me is volatility. That will be his legacy because volatility encompasses both. It encompasses the highs and the lows. And there's been some really, really high highs. And there's been some really low lows. And, you know, obviously on the high end, you think of the last season, right, eclipsing 100 points, being a two-way force under Rick Tocchet for them, being really clutch in the playoffs. I certainly think back to the original Lotto line season, his first season here when that trio took off and were one of the best lines in the NHL. They go into the bubble that year. And then you think of the lows, of course, too. And, you know, we're living through one, or we had been living through one over the last couple of months, or really this season. So that might be fresh on some people's minds, but I don't think it's going to be possible to tell the story of JT Miller as a Canuck fairly and honestly without including the very high highs and the pretty low lows as well.
So I think the legacy's twofold. First off, I think the truth is that he was the most discussed Canuck since the heyday of Roberto Luongo, right? He was the most scrutinized, the most criticized, the most celebrated, right? He was often the face of Vancouver's failures and the face of their successes. And as you noted, it was a volatile period of time in which he was here, right? Alternatively, you had the moments where, you know, he put the team on his back against the Nashville Predators. Like that was a JT Miller and Brock Besser and Artur Shelov's win the Canucks a playoff round performance. And then he did the best job checking Connor McDavid that anyone did in the 2024 playoffs, except for Alexander Barkov, a perennial Selke Trophy winner. And by the way, the level McDavid hit as an individual player was probably the highest level we've seen anyone hit in the playoffs in 30 years. I can't even think of who else I'd maybe Evgeny Malkin in like 2009. Right? Like it was ludicrous what McDavid was doing and Miller slowed him down 5 of 7 games. He gave this team a chance to win against an Edmonton Oilers team that, you know, got within a game of the Stanley Cup and probably should have won it, frankly. Incredible, right? The high highs that Miller hit were unbelievable. And you also had the emotional leader stuff. Mm-hmm. You also had, you know, the moment where he stood up for his teammates in the wake of the COVID-19 outbreak, criticized the league and the organization, frankly, got the games pushed back, like moved an NHL schedule. JT Miller, at his most assertive, was able to move the NHL schedule.
For his teammates. Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think you remember that. And then, of course, you know, there's the Delia stuff and the when things were bad, Miller was the face of it. When things were great, Miller was the face of it. And so in some ways, he just dominated. Soaked up so much oxygen across this era of Canucks hockey. And I think that's the first part of it. The second part of it, the part that I'll remember, you know, in terms of covering him and watching him play every night, was the way that this guy came in, right? Acquired to be like Bo Horvat's winger.
Yes.
Acquired to be Bo Horvat's winger in 2019. You know, Miller moved to center, then leveled up as a two-way player, then became a 100-point center, right? Mm-hmm. And became defensively reliable enough that I'd describe his performance against McDavid in the playoffs the way I just did, right? Did the best job that anyone did, but the best defensive player of his generation, right? When you think about it that way, right, I do think there's an element to which, you know, Miller's legacy should remain, you know, now that it's done, now that it's over, I know his legacy will also be defined by what I'm sure comes out over the next 2-3 weeks about how everything went wrong in Vancouver. Like, I'm sure that will be part of it. So the final chapter's not yet written, even if the trade is done and the trade call is in and the ink is dry on this particular exchange. But I do think, you know, the fact that he leaves Vancouver as one of two Canucks to be over a point per game in their 10 years and Pavel Bure's the other, right? The way that he was able to improve and adapt and evolve as a player and the way he resonated in this marketplace. You know, I think his legacy as a Canuck should probably focus on that, the status of him as a cult hero in this market. Like, you know, somewhere between Bertuzzi and Kessler will live JT Miller and sort of the memories and hearts of Canucks fans. And I think that's fitting, just given what he accomplished over the course of his Canucks tenure.
And certainly, as we've seen in the case of, you know, Ryan Kessler very recently, Todd Bertuzzi, but, you know, Pavel Bure as well, even when the ending is a little awkward or there's some bad feeling or there were some volatile moments in a player's tenure with the Canucks, the longer you go out from it, the more people focus on the good times, right? And there were, as I said, some very, very good times, and that connection between the fans at Rogers and JT Miller was very, very significant. And you're right, in the moment, you know, and maybe we'll hear more. We'll see about what went on behind the scenes and all that. But as the years go by, it's going to be the good times and that connection that stands out. Okay, quickly, you know, we can't do this without talking about the other side of this rift and, you know, what went on behind the scenes, which is Elias Pettersson. And so now the two big questions are, one, is he off the table? Because, I mean, it was just a week ago that we heard they were very, very close to dealing him to the Carolina Hurricanes. Jim Rutherford has said, you know, it might not be a case of we trade one of these guys and it fixes it. Maybe we have to do both. We'll see. What does the immediate future hold for Elias Pettersson, both in terms of the club's plans for him? I know you and I have talked about, okay, if you do the Miller trade, can you at least give Elias Pettersson kind of 30 games to step up to the plate and make the case that he can be your franchise center still long-term before his no-move clause kicks in? So it's, what does the organization think? Do they view this as, you know, as we're outlining it and saying, okay, well, let's see what Pettersson does now. Are they still looking to trade him? And for Pettersson, does this give him an opportunity? Like, you described JT Miller as taking up a lot of the oxygen, right? Both in good ways and in bad ways. With that out of the room, off the team, is that what Elias Pettersson needed truly to get back to being that superstar version of Elias Pettersson?
Well, I think the answer is he better, right?
Yes.
The answer is he better. Now, we've seen that Pettersson has held his value. I still think he'll hold his value. In my view, anyway, you know, if you're pivoting and now that this first part of that pivot is in the books, I don't know if the club should rush to deal Pettersson at this stage, but I also don't know exactly what's transpired, right? So, you know, the club's actions are going to tell us a lot here. With Miller gone, you know, if this team's going to make the playoffs this year, if they're going to pull this off, if they're going to continue to be a team, you know, with having subtracted from this core and with an eye toward rebuilding it quickly enough to make a compelling pitch to Quinn Hughes over the next 18 months, right? Is Pettersson going to be the face of that, or is he another pivot point? Like, he's going to answer that question himself if the club hasn't already made up their minds. And this next 32 games is going to speak volumes. So, you know, I do think there's an awful lot at stake here for the club and for Pettersson over the balance of this season.
All right, there you go. There is some instant reaction. JT Miller traded to the New York Rangers. His tenure as a Vancouver Canuck is done. We'll see what comes out, whether when we hear from Canucks management on this. Do we hear from JT Miller as a Ranger soon? And we will be back on Monday at noon on 650 on Canucks Talk to break it all down. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you on Monday.